Hi, my name is Nada Ahmed, and I am your host for the Braving Innovation Podcast. I am passionate about helping teams and leaders reach their strategic ambitions through innovation. I believe every company and team can bring new products and services to market and achieve immense success in creating sustainable and profitable business models. All you need is an inclusive innovation mindset, have access to proven tools and strategies, and a robust network of mentors to guide you. Through this podcast, I bring to you inspiring stories, tips, and strategies from leaders all around the world so that you can excel on your journey as an entrepreneur, innovation leader, and investor. Welcome to Braving Innovation.
Today, I am super excited to have with me Matt Weinberg, who is joining us early in the morning from New York City. Matt works as a principal at Max Ventures, an early stage venture capital fund based out of New York City that primarily invests in digital commerce and digital healthcare startups across the United States and Scandinavia, which I think is super exciting. And that's why we have you here. And before joining Max Ventures, Matt worked under the Obama administration as a White House appointee in the U.S. Small Business Administration and served as a senior advisor in the Office of Investment and Innovation. Again, very exciting. And I'm a little bit jealous that you got to meet Obama and maybe work with him. You have to tell us about that if you did. He has also worked at the New York City Economic Development Corporation, where he helped play a pivotal role in helping New York City build its entrepreneurial ecosystem and become like the place second only to Silicon Valley for entrepreneurship and tech. And it'll be really exciting if we can dive into that also. So many interesting topics, Matt. Thank you for being here.
Sure. Thank you so much for having me. Nada, I appreciate it and excited to be here.
So a question I like to get started with, because this is, after all, Braving Innovation, is I like to ask my guests to tell us about a time when they had to be exceptionally brave, when they really had to really muster their courage to do something or say something or not do something. What comes to your mind?
That's a good question. I think, you know, maybe more broadly, the time where I felt the least inspired and the least able to pull myself together and bring myself to kind of go to work, take the train to the office in DC and keep on, you know, working in my current capacity in the Obama administration was the day that Donald Trump won the presidency in November 2016. And so I just remember the next day, you know, having fundamentally different views on our country and honestly on our relationship to technology and innovation, because as you'll remember, those tech platforms had a lot to do with the outcome, I believe, had a lot to do with the outcome of that. Not just their fault, obviously, it's a confluence of factors, some of it lack of oversight to those platforms, but a lot of it, you know, lack of knowledge on how to tap into, you know, what was driving all that angst and anger in the American population from the side of the Democrats. So, you know, a lot of factors led to that, but, you know, really kind of started to think differently about our relationship with technology and how to really drive innovation in a responsible way. And my position in government was very closely tied to working with the tech sector. And so, you know, waking up that next day, you know, fundamentally deflated and defeated, you know, pulling myself together and honestly around noon, not around 9 or 8:30 like I normally would, around noon or 1 o'clock, getting to the office and then, you know, having real conversations with senior leadership and my colleagues about how to move forward our initiatives and priorities. Well, we still had a few months left in the administration to ensure that, you know, we handed it off to the next administration in the strongest position as possible. But that day to me was the hardest. And, you know, keeping, you know, our obligations moving forward was something that, you know, was distressing to me at the time. But, you know, overall, we did a lot of great work those last 3 months, started the process of reevaluating the government's relationship with technology. And I think left our offices in a better place than we found them.
I can not even imagine what it would have felt like to you. I know many of us woke up that next day, actually probably weren't even able to go to sleep that night, thinking, oh my God, what has just happened? I think probably on both sides of the table, because it was unexpected what happened. Sure. And for someone to have been working in the administration and then knowing that you're going to have to continue coming in every day and doing your best work and then hand over to a new administration. Yeah, I can only imagine the amount of courage that required and kind of the mental shift that you had to reframe some things in your mind to still be motivated and inspired to continue the work?
We were thinking we were going to hand it over to, you know, Hillary Clinton's people, who were our, you know, close colleagues and friends for a long time. So it was a different mindset, different paradigm, a huge paradigm shift, no doubt.
So then what did you do afterwards?
So after the administration, I was a political appointee, which just means that I was tied to the administration, the Obama administration. So I was time oriented to my role. So on inauguration day for President Donald Trump, that was my last day. So it was January 20th, 2017. I packed up my boxes. I went to a big dinner with a bunch of friends. And then I started thinking about the next chapter of my life. And fortunately, I kind of had a backup plan to go back to school and get my master's. I'd been putting off a long time. I thought previously I might go earlier, but I really needed to spend the last, 2 years administration doing all the amazing work that I had the opportunity to do to serve the American people from an innovation and investment context. But luckily, I kind of had a backup plan to go back to school. And then I did a few different mini projects. One was working for a startup in the Bay Area that helped home chefs sell meals out of their kitchen. So very interesting. It was actually an interesting sort of impact startup where it helped create economic opportunities for folks in certain communities, a lot of single parents, a lot of immigrant communities, helping them drive additional income through selling food. But there was a regulatory issue there, right? Because selling food out of your kitchen sometimes can require, oversight, require insurance, require that the health standards are met. So I helped them navigate a bunch of those issues. It was a really fascinating company. And then I also started, my venture capital career working for an old Obama administration colleague, doing more financial technology innovation. So helping drive capital into companies that were changing the financial services sector. I then went to school and got my MBA from Columbia University, which really have that, be an alum there, great school, and obviously gave me a chance to move back to New York City. So as Nada mentioned, I worked in the Economic Development Agency here in New York City. Again, driving programs that help the tech and startup sectors here. But being back in Columbia was fantastic. I got to re-engage with a bunch of old colleagues and really, start my next chapter of my career, which for me is not government for at least a few years. After working in government for 8 years, I needed a break. And so I was very fortunate to link up with the team at Max Ventures, MAX Ventures, and start the next chapter of my career.
So coming to New York, doing your MBA at Columbia.
Yes, correct.
And in fact, that's how I got introduced to Matt, because of a program, a venture capital and private equity program at Columbia University. I'm just curious to understand, when you were working with the government, you were working a lot with innovation and investment to some extent. So
sure.
It seemed natural to then pursue something in venture capital. It wasn't something that you had to start from scratch.
Yeah, I did. That's right. I think my role in the government was really, twofold. I think one bucket was hard investment, right? So the government has tons of financial resources that it makes available to startups, early stage technology firms, young R&D profile companies that, can apply for a host of grants and sort of economic incentives, but more from a financial side. The other half of it, is more programmatic, right? So the City of New York and then the federal government, they come up with interesting programs to help entrepreneurs and help kind of grow, quote unquote, innovation ecosystems. So New York is obviously municipal focused here in the city, but they would have different programs for all of the sectors here that are very vibrant. So think fashion, think real estate, think media, think even financial services. They would create specific programs to help entrepreneurs and innovation in those particular sectors. Nationwide, they would do similar, but it was, kind of more top line where they would have a lot of programs aimed at helping accelerate digital healthcare or even crypto, blockchain, 5G, clean energy, all of these kind of big technology topics. The government had a lot of programs aimed at helping entrepreneurs succeed financially and also sort of from a resource and programmatic capacity. So I was very fortunate to get a lot of exposure to those programs and work, really closely with a lot of talented entrepreneurs, a lot of talented venture capital investors. And yeah, when I transitioned, out of government, I think I had a good head start in pursuing, investing from the private sector side.
So picking then up on a little bit on your work with the New York City Economic Development Corporation and sure. The story you kind of told about how in a matter of really a decade, New York really positioned itself as a leading player when it comes to entrepreneurship, venture capital. Before it was New York in the U.S. and New York City, Boston were known for these to be the place to be. But you would think that New York City had what it needed to be that hub. So what levers did you use? What really did New York City have to do to attract venture capital and entrepreneurships in New York?
Yeah, it's a good question. You know, I think that New York is very unique and it has certain strengths and weaknesses. I think in 2008, 9, 10, it was very over-indexed in the financial services sector, right? So New York City is known as the hub of finance, Wall Street, et cetera. And it was obviously particularly vulnerable to what happened in 2008, 2009, 2010, the Great Recession. So, you know, the crash slash, you know, the economic turmoil that happened in those years really overweightedly impacted New York City. So the mayor at the time, Mayor Bloomberg, Michael Bloomberg, you know, I think really understood that and saw the pain that New York went through because they're over-indexed in a particular services or a particular area of the economy, financial services, and really set out to transform the economy. So, you know, writing on the wall in 2009-10, you know, you're seeing Silicon Valley kind of emerge. You're seeing companies like Apple, Facebook, Microsoft, you know, even Amazon, which is in Seattle, but, you know, it obviously has a big presence in Silicon Valley from like an investment standpoint. But yeah, so you're seeing the rise of tech, you know, during that era, and the Bloomberg administration really set out to be competitive from an investment, from an innovation, from a startup and entrepreneurship growth standpoint. So it set off the first big thing it did. It realized that it did not have a huge tech campus, that it did not have an engineering sort of factory, so to speak, that rivaled that of Harvard, MIT, and Stanford. And so it set off to open up a worldwide competition called Cornell. Well, now it's called Cornell Tech, but it was a worldwide competition to build an innovation campus on Roosevelt Island, which is an island in the East River here in New York, and received bids from all over the world and accepted one that was a joint partnership from Cornell and Technion University in Israel. And that has become Cornell Tech, which is now a live operational campus in Roosevelt Island, you know, geared towards tech and sort of future engineering skills. And, you know, it's graduating engineers every year. So that was first, right? It knew that it needed sort of homegrown to be competitive with a Boston, to be competitive with a San Francisco. But then it underwent a host of different initiatives and undertook a host of different programs and I think put a lot of resources towards a lot of different areas. So like we mentioned before, New York is so lucky that it is economically diverse, but I just don't think those industries had received a lot of attention from a government and venture capital standpoint, because venture capital industry in 2010 was nascent and, you know, the government had not quite, you know, become sophisticated enough to incentivize interaction between venture capital and startup. So, you know, it would just occur naturally, but the government has a big role to play in New York City specifically. So it would do a lot of events where it convened investors, it convened entrepreneurs, it would actually invest its dollars directly into, you know, little echo. So yeah, invest its dollars directly into startups. The city actually had its own investment vehicle. And then it really focused on all these different sectors. So it focused on fashion, it focused on media, it focused on life science, on healthcare, on real estate, and it built specific programming for those industries, for entrepreneurs to succeed. And so 10 years later, you know, you had a fruition, you see that it came to fruition, where you see all of these entrepreneurs across different sectors, you know, having all of these really vibrant industries in New York City from an innovation and entrepreneurship perspective. You have all of this venture capital that flocked to the city, that grew up here in the city, that received funding from the finance community and from the broader sort of finance ecosystem. And so you have 10 years later, you have New York as the unequivocal number two ecosystem in the country, only behind Silicon Valley, way ahead of Boston, you know, light years ahead of cities like Austin and Miami. And, you know, that, you know, some of it is market conditions, right? The rise of tech, the rise of venture capital. You saw that nationwide from 2010 to 2020, you know, grew everywhere. But New York is a really sophisticated support infrastructure. The city is very well resourced. It has a lot of levers at its disposal, and it used all of them to ensure that New York City transformed into the innovation hub that it is today.
That's very impressive. And what I'm hearing is really it required that leadership from the mayor and also a crisis, the financial crisis of 2008. And that often is what gets us to start thinking about we need to pivot and not be so dependent on one industry. And given that it is a quite diverse ecosystem, let's build on that.
Yeah. And it's, you know, nothing to take away from the entrepreneurs and the private sector, you know, partners and the talent of the sort of business leaders in the business community, the private sector. I mean, New York City has the most talented people in the world. And so, you know, you had a good confluence of factors that led to really positive outcomes, you know, working with city, state, even academic, nonprofit, you know, all of those sort of entities kind of came together and really helped drive the city forward economically.
Great. I would like to now pivot a little bit on to, I'm based out of here in Scandinavia. I've seen over the past five years in Scandinavia just a rise in the amount of entrepreneurial activity and the building of the ecosystem. And of course, largely driven by Sweden. And Max Ventures have also made it an important part of their strategy to look for companies to invest in Sweden. So maybe you could tell us a little bit about your journey there to Sweden and why you strongly believe that the Nordic region, so not only just Sweden, will be an amazing place to invest going forward.
Sure. And are you based in Oslo?
Yes.
Okay, cool. Mm-hmm. I'm supposed to go to Oslo this Sunday. So maybe I can meet you in person for lunch.
Yes, let's meet up in person for sure.
Yes, that's great. So Sweden for us was somewhat opportunistic. We're one of our anchor investors in our funds. Our fund is Max Ventures. And we started in 2015, really investing out of a family office. So it was before my time. I was still in the Obama administration. But my partner now was investing for a family called the Steinbeck family, which is a very large business family or sort of, you know, ubiquitous, notorious, if you want to call it, business family from Sweden. And, you know, he was doing early stage investment for them, was very successful, ended up convincing them to partner with him as he went out to launch his own fund. So they became our anchor investor, you know, kind of our first major seven-figure check. And, you know, not only did that help us get off the ground because we had capital to invest, but it opened up the Swedish ecosystem because it's a very well-known name in Sweden. So, you know, having the ability to say, you know, we're a fund that has an anchor investor with the Steinbecks, or Steinbecks being the anchor, you know, really opened up some doors for us. But I would say that, you know, there's no cheat code to building community, to making partnerships, especially in early stage venture where it's a very people-driven business. So we went for the first maybe 2-3 years of our fund, went to Sweden, made the right partnerships, you know, tried to earn trust in the community, you know, developed the right network where, you know, we felt comfortable investing and kind of, you know, calling ourselves somewhat of experts in the venture capital /startup ecosystem in Stockholm. So we started making investments a few years ago in Sweden. We do about 20% of our investing there. But yeah, it's a mix of opportunistic, you know, kind of taking advantage of an opportunity, being opportunistic, but then also, you know, making sure that we didn't squander it. So, you know, ensuring that we were very thoughtful and intentional about how we wanted to invest in Sweden and doing the work and all the legwork required to make sure we were successful there.
Yeah. So one fact I picked up from your presentation last time was that Sweden accounts for 25% of the 56 billion total value of unicorns in top European nations. So that's a lot. So there's definitely... And we know big names from Sweden, right? We know Skype, Spotify, iZettle, there are more. What have you found from your work there now, 6-7 years? Any sort of major differences you see in Sweden versus the startup ecosystem in New York City or in general in the US?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, first and foremost, Sweden is a country of 10 million, right? And its neighbors even less. So, if you're starting a company in Scandinavia, you have a very global first mindset. So you're very eager to get out of your home country, expand to neighboring countries, even expand to the US. Well, in the US, the American market is just so massive. Well, yeah, you kind of have a geographic strategy for maybe starting in New York and moving to Florida, moving to Texas. But it's way different, way less barriers of entry to sort of expanding state by state, although there can be high ones from a regulatory standpoint. It depends on the industry. But generally, you know, there's less barriers. You can permeate your market a bit easier. In Stockholm, in Europe, you know, you're very likely to need to go global very quick to become a big business. So the global mindset is definitely different than the American mindset. Maybe that relates to like Americans in general, not having the most global mindset. A lot of factors there we could get into. But yeah, so global mindset's one. Two is, you know, and this is something I'd love to study more. So there's a few programs out there that kind of give you some resources to study. But I think that the social programming in Sweden is more conducive to entrepreneurship. So, you know, considerable, you know, welfare and sort of social resources that it provides to its population. A lot of it certainly, you know, for education, for healthcare, but there's also more nuanced programs. So one is, you know, really, really deep childcare resources. Another is like maternity and paternity leave. Another is actually like encouragement from the government to start your own company. So I think that the really vast and sophisticated network of resource social welfare programs actually encourages entrepreneurship, right? Because it sort of puts a safety net under you that if you jump and fall, you're not going to crash into the ground and, you know, be destitute, you know, have a really big setback in life and in your career. And I think that leads to more entrepreneurship. Third, you know, I think that they're more humble than American entrepreneurs. I think they're a little more mellow, a little more realistic in a sense, which is, you know, good from who you want to work with standpoint, but sometimes can be a little, I don't know, off-putting is the wrong word, but can give pause to the American investor who really wants that founder to come in and be like, we're going to be the next Tesla or the next, you know, Facebook, or we're going to be a unicorn or worth $10 billion. We're going to IPO in a few years. You know, they're very more measured with how they explain, you know, their companies, their success, their upside. And, you know, I think sometimes that's unfortunately to their detriment. And there's a little bit lack of sort of the salesy sophistication that a lot of American entrepreneurs have, for better or for worse.
Yeah, I can definitely relate to two of the points that you made. So one about the safety net. I just quit my job at end of last year, and a lot of people were like, you know, how can you do that? I've worked in corporate most of my career. That's a big risk that you're taking. But I was like, I live in Norway. I have a healthcare system. My kids are still going to go to school. So this is the best place for me to actually take a risk. And secondly, in terms of Norwegians, Scandinavians in general being more on the humble side, and that can sometimes to Americans seem like, are they ambitious enough, right? Because for Americans, it's kind of like you have to really, maybe in some extent, really, you know, exaggerate or say, this is going to be our sales, whereas the culture here is a little bit, it's part of our culture, something we call Janteloven, the tall poppy syndrome, right? Everyone's equal. Mm-hmm. And we're not supposed to be better than anybody else. And so it's somehow rooted in that egalitarian system, which has been really good in some way. Right. But in this kind of cutthroat sometimes entrepreneurial world, there's a different type of mentality that we might need. Yep. But did you find something that was kind of unexpected, some surprises of working in Sweden that you could share with us? Maybe some fun startups that you found that you want to talk to?
I mean, nothing was surprising. I mean, it was all new to me, right? So I had a pretty open mind. I had studied a lot of different entrepreneurship ecosystems across the country. So like, what does Cincinnati look like compared to New York, compared to Milwaukee, compared to Denver? So I was really excited to, you know, get into Stockholm and see what it was all about. You know, surprising. I mean, there's just lovely people. I mean, the nicest people that I've probably come across, you know, very warm, welcoming, very collaborative. Everyone seems accessible to each other. That might just be a syndrome of having a small ecosystem. So I remember New York was much more like that in 2012, 13 than it is today. But, you know, very, very much, you know, enjoyed my time there. And then, yeah, a few awesome startups that we invested in. One is recently Starmony, which is supposed to democratize access to creating music. So it allows people to, you know, record themselves and make themselves sound, you know, professional, which is something I would desperately need if I ever tried to create my own song. And they're doing really well. And then we have another one, Clara, which we love. This is, you know, they're blowing up, they're exploding, but this is a marketplace to help understand electric vehicle purchasing and sort of all the different auxiliary products or services that you would need if you're owning an electric vehicle. I think there's a lot of that sort of knowledge built for, you know, the gas sort of combustible engine, but for electric cars, and that marketplace has yet to exist. So Clara is doing it, you know, obviously in a country and part of the world that's really, you know, forward and really sort of spearheading climate change technology and innovation, or at least from like a thinking and policy perspective. And then lastly, there's this really interesting company called Sana Labs, which is started by this guy, Joel Hallmark, who is a young whiz kid. I think he's still like 24, 25. I was at a dinner with him. We did our last event in 2019 in Stockholm. We called it Moose Tech. So we convened the, you know, sort of leadership in the Stockholm and Sweden technology and innovation and investment ecosystems. And then we also brought 100 American investors and entrepreneurs to Sweden for 3 days of programming. So really fantastic. 2019, different era. We hope to do it again soon. But I was sitting next to him and we were just talking about life and business. And then he mentioned to me that he was 24. And I was like, wow, you sounded like you were 34 at least. So I think he's still very young and, you know, driving a company forward called Sana Labs, which is basically AI for learning. So really individualized, the concept of individualized and personal learning and the ability to apply AI to help give students in any topic, yeah, elementary or kind of school age students, but also students studying, you know, vocations like nursing or technology, giving them really customized content and education and training materials to ensure that they can have the most successful outcomes possible. So that's a great company we're really excited about. But in Sweden, it's very diverse. And I don't think we have a specific sector we invest in. We're just trying to find the best entrepreneurs to support and partner with and help them expand to the American market and grow into a big success.
That sounds great. I noted down those startups, they sound like they definitely have a future, especially with now Max Ventures investing in them. So great. And excited about you being in Norway also, because we could definitely use some more diversity in our, as we're building our venture capital ecosystem here within Norway too. We definitely need more investors from outside of Norway. And over the past 5-6 years, we've seen, you know, up to six unicorns come from Norway, which we are really, really proud of. So any tips from you also for other cities, countries within Europe on what we can learn from Sweden and also from New York on building these ecosystems?
Yeah, it's a good question. So look, I think that the obsession with becoming the next Silicon Valley, I think, is sort of a misnomer, right? Silicon Valley is just like it's like a Galapagos Island. This professor, Margaret O'Mara, is one of my favorite authors and professors from the University of Washington. You know, she kind of described it as Galapagos, where it evolved very uniquely with an influx of migration from the East Coast in the 40s and 50s, to a huge influx of government capital, to Stanford University emerging, to, you know, these really like unique factors came together to make Silicon Valley what it is today. So I think that cities should focus on, you know, what their strengths are, right? Also what their weaknesses are, what their hard assets are, what their soft assets are. I mean, to contextualize that, you know, New York has hard assets in the fact that it has, you know, economic activity across many different sectors, like we talked about, like media, fashion, you know, real estate, financial services, and to really, you know, generate entrepreneurial growth across those, that's taking advantage of a strength and of a condition that the city has already. And a hard asset, I think, is, you know, between a soft asset, I think hard asset is like actual dollars that it has to contribute or incentives or, you know, different sort of subsidies. And then a soft asset is around, you know, competitions or, you know, convening events, like leadership panels, like bringing people together. I think those are more soft assets, but the cities have to look at what's their strengths and what's their weaknesses. And I think evaluate if they want to kind of take advantage of their strengths or put resources towards fixing their weaknesses. I mean, New York weakness is high taxes. It's, you know, lack of affordability. It's like really expensive talent. And, you know, you don't always want to spend your resources addressing weaknesses. I mean, sometimes you want to just spend your resources addressing your strengths. So I think cities should kind of look at that economic development matrix. At least it's helped me as a policy professional, and then even in my venture capital career now. But all cities, you know, don't need to be San Francisco. So you see a city like Miami trying to bang its you know, spear on the shield, saying that it's going to be the next Silicon Valley. It's a little bit misleading, where I think that Miami has a lot going for it, where it could, you know, really sort of hone in its focus and generate a lot of interesting growth and activity through more focused approaches. But end of the day, I think it's a partnership, right, between the private sector, between the public sector, between your university system, between your nonprofit system. And it's really like a multidisciplinary approach to economic development. And all cities have different levels of resources, different levels of professionals, different levels of like a tax base, especially in America. Some cities are just so underfinanced and some have a lot of capital, like in New York. So I think it just depends, but, you know, I hope that was somewhat intelligent.
Definitely. No, I think I really liked how you framed it as sort of the hard and soft assets that we have and really leveraging our strengths, really starting from there to build it. So our time is just running so fast. There's so much more we could talk about. But one more question I had for you before we end was around, you mentioned you worked for this startup that was providing soup and really empowering the local communities. And I know that's kind of, diversity is also something that you feel very strongly for. So what are you guys doing at Max Ventures that helps and supports impact startups that are also going to be making a lot of money for you?
Sure. So I think you know, for us, we're not an impact fund. It's just the nature of being a small emerging fund. I mean, it's just not our model. You know, I wish that we did more impact investing and we had the resources and sort of timeline to consider our impact broadly. I mean, we'll get there 100%, but we're just so young right now that we just have different priorities. But we do focus a lot on healthcare, and we have invested in a few climate companies as well. So Clara is one, Climate View is another one. So that one I should have mentioned, but that's a Swedish company that I absolutely love. They help sell, or they sell technology to governments to help them evaluate and track their climate plans. So if you're a city and you have all these, you know, spectrum of climate and resiliency and sort of sustainability policies and plans, you know, Climate View creates a dashboard for you to, as a city, to monitor them and track them. So, you know, the climate investing is something that we're looking more into. I think it's really exciting, and it's also, you know, huge impact, and it's a growing market. But healthcare for us specifically right now, I think anything in healthcare is impact, especially in the American market, which is so twisted and backwards, where if you're providing new access to care, new models for increasing access, increasing quality, lowering cost, I mean, for me, that's impact 101. So healthcare for us has been a very, you know, awesome area to invest in from an economics and return perspective. But from an impact perspective, it's what gets me out of bed every day and makes me really excited to be an investor.
Yeah, no, and absolutely. And I think I believe in a future, and I think it's true today, too, that they're not mutually exclusive. But I really believe that in the future, we're not going to make that differentiation, that more and more all the capital will be going to companies that are actually making a positive impact in the society in terms of the environment and all the other different things that we care about. Because at the end of the day, that's really what's giving us more value as a society, right? So, yep. So thank you for sharing all of that. We got some really good tips and advice from you. Also, for those of us listening from Norway and elsewhere, any ask that you might have of people listening to the podcast later on Spotify and Apple Podcasts, how can they get in touch with you? What kind of things would you like to hear about?
Sure. Yeah, I'm not sure the geographic distribution of your audience, but if anyone's sort of working in tech and innovation across Europe, I would be really interested to know what they're seeing on the ground today, what sort of the most exciting, you know, startups or young new companies or new sort of business models emerging from their geographies, especially if you're in Scandinavia. Sounds like maybe a few folks are. And then, yeah, to keep in touch, I mean, if they keep in touch with you, Nada, please feel free to pass along my email if it's a question that you think I can answer. So happy to keep in touch with anyone and you know, have a conversation about any of the topics we discussed today.
That's great. Thank you for joining us today, Matt.
Thank you for listening to the Braving Innovation Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, do hit subscribe so you do not miss any of our future episodes. Don't forget to leave us a review and share this podcast with others who might find it valuable. Thank you.